This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture from your friends at NPR. I'm Alicia Montgomery, producer of Tell Me More.
And I'm Justine Kennan, producing these days for All Things Considered.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, a memoir from Cornel West.
Cinematographer Roger Deakins on creating the perfect shot.
And a review of the Michael Jackson film, This Is It. But first, music video games like Guitar Hero and Rock Band are among the world's most popular, earning billions of dollars selling to gamers who delight in shredding along to Jimi Hendrix or Aerosmith. Our very own Netta Ulubi says the company that makes Guitar Hero is tweaking that franchise with a new game that lets you rock the club from your couch.
The game is called DJ Hero, and it's about as true to actual DJing as Guitar Hero is to actual rock stardom. Jamie Jackson is creative director of Freestyle Games, that developed both DJ and Guitar Hero.
It's not about you being a DJ and simulating. That wasn't the idea. It's about having fun and feeling like you're controlling the party. So all the music is pre-made by our DJs.
Meaning it's a pre-mixed, pre-sampled, pre-beat-matched assortment of popular tunes. Freestyle developers worked with about 20 DJs to figure out how to turn turntabling into something playable on an Xbox. It works like Guitar Hero, but instead of that plastic guitar, you get a fake turntable and a fake little mixer, while a funky DJ avatar struts, cuts, and scratches on screen.
He is enjoying himself.
Robert Carter is a DJ who plays nationally under the name DJ Cousin B. By day, you'll find him including audio for NPR's website. I asked him to play DJ Hero.
It takes some getting used to, but then again, this is a game.
Freestyle Games recruited a few illustrious DJs to add cred.
It's your boy, DJ Grandmaster Flash. I'm going to be a professor.
Okay, you got Flash on here, okay. So it's official.
Now let's talk about tapping.
I've never had Flash teach me how to DJ, so let's do it.
We decided to pit DJ Cousin B against a gamer, NPR intern Brian Reardon.
You're overthinking it. You just got to move it. Just moving it back and forth.
Yeah, I'm overthinking it. I'm at an NPR, not the club.
DJ Cousin B was experiencing the same problems some guitar players have with Guitar Hero. Real skills don't translate. They confuse you.
That's weird. Because you normally don't scratch with just one finger, so it's really strange, but okay.
When Freestyle Games first developed DJ Hero, creative director Jamie Jackson asked regular people what they thought DJs did.
99% of them put one hand to their ear and the other made a scratching sound and kind of went, wicka, wicka, wicka.
See, I mean, I don't know anything about turntables, and I'm sure, like I have no idea what this, I've never known what guys are doing when they do that.
Gamer Brian Reardon still utterly destroys the DJ in this virtual battle. Robert Carter is a fabulous DJ in real life. He's not fabulous at scoring points in the game's glamorous industrial nightclub.
You are just stinking up the joint.
They just booed me.
Oh, you didn't even get one star.
I didn't get a star, man. They booed me.
Is there anything about this that's like actual DJing?
DJs fantasize for an environment like this. You have about 30,000 people out there going crazy. I mean, it's everybody's reacting. No fights out there.
DJ Cousin B, a.k.a. Robert Carter, says this game is perfect if you want to one-up a DJ.
Say, man, like, you know, I think you would be nice at DJ Hero. Let me check you out. And you just kill him.
Still, Carter plans to get the game for his little 8-year-old nephew. In a few years, he says, he'll teach him how to DJ for real. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
You know, DJing seems like one of those things that it's one of those jobs where you think it's going to be fun, but it's a job. And your job is to make sure that other people are having fun, which is not necessarily the same thing as having a good time yourself. So I'm glad that DJs are out there, but I don't necessarily want to play one on the video game.
Yeah, and I'm no gamer, I'll let you know that.
Well, he hasn't been a DJ, but he has been a rapper. We're talking about scholar Cornel West. For decades now, Cornel West has been a leading voice on politics, religion, race, and culture. He's been a teacher at Princeton and Harvard universities and an author whose books include bestsellers like Race Matters and his new memoir, Living and Loving Out Loud. West was on NPR's Talk of the Nation with host Neil Conan when a caller asked about the differences between hip-hop and rap.
Rap is just a moment within the larger culture of hip-hop. Carriers, one and others, as you know, have theorized this in such a way that hip-hop embraces a variety of different activities. Rap is a moment in. You got graffiti and a host of other moments as well. But the important thing for me as an educator is how do we unsettle the minds and touch the souls of significant numbers of young people who don't read text or don't read my text. And that's why I've made three CDs. It's spoken word, but I have a number of hip-hop artists. Talib Kweli's on there. KRS-One is on there. M1 is there. Rod Digger is there. Jill Scott is there. Prince, of course, collaborating with the musical genius of our time in some ways, with Prince himself, late great Gerald Levert. All these are forms of singing education, and what the Greeks call paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, that deep education to get us to shift from superficial things to serious things, to shift from bling bling to life and death and justice and pain and joy, those fundamental elemental things that we must come to terms with as we make our moves from our mother's womb to the tomb. And I think hip-hop can be prophetic and progressive, but at the same time, the dominant forms tend to be homophobic, misogynistic, and something that we need to critically call into question.
That's why I actually called. I kind of beg with you. All those positive aspects, those artists you name, I consider those hip-hop artists. And those with the negativity, with no poetry involved, no substance involved, I consider that. Right?
Oh, I see. So, yeah, you've got your own definition different than Brother KRS-One and the others. In a certain sense, we're concerned about the same issues. How do you accent the progressive, the prophetic, those things that are critical of all forms of injustice, all forms of bigotry, all forms of dehumanizing other people, and yet still allow for a certain kind of flow, linguistic flow, certain kinds of melodies and harmonies in the samplings to take place? But I think KRS-One in some ways has laid out the real framework, because there's a number of hip-hop artists who are highly talented but politically retrograde.
Justine, I've heard a lot of Cornel West, and I he reminds me of this college professor I had like 20 years ago at NYU, and he was a philosophy professor, and he was always talking about Descartes, the guy who said, "I think, therefore I am." And one of the things he said about Descartes was, you know, he got in his head and he couldn't get out. And sometimes when you're listening to Cornel West talk about, you know, pop culture, you know, it's sometimes a song is just a song, you know, and you never get that sense hearing him talk about rap and hip hop. Maybe he's seeing something in some of these songs that I'm just not seeing.
Perhaps you and I can go to Minneapolis and take a class directly from Prince. I think that would be the plan for me.
Me too. You can hear the full interview with Cornel West at npr.org/culturetopia.
Cinematographer Roger Deakins has been nominated for 8 Oscars. He's best known for his work on A Beautiful Mind, Shawshank Redemption, and nearly every film from the Coen brothers, including Fargo and No Country for Old Men. NPR's Melissa Block was recently in Santa Monica and talked with Deakins about the use of computer-generated imagery in the art of the happy accident.
Conrad Ho is a great... the greatest cinematographer, probably. He always called it the happy accident that always happens on a set, that sometimes you'll see something will happen and you realize you can do something visually, either with lighting or with the way you move the camera, that you couldn't have done on the page, in the script, in the words, you know, and that happens a lot. I mean, it's usually we might do a scene in one shot instead of covering it in 5, you know.
You can... fix things, you mean reinvent things?
Fix things in post. It's one of the worst expressions to come into the industry. But on the other hand, again, take a film like Jarhead, which we shot it all handheld in the desert, but in the background there's mountains, and Sam didn't want anything, no mountains. He wanted this flat kind of surreal landscape, emptiness, horizon going into nothing. So all the mountains were taken out digitally afterwards. But if it's used correctly, it's a fantastic technique. But
well, that's the danger, I suppose.
That's
this fix it in post, I can tell by the way you say it. You hate it. It's anathema to you, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Why? Because Explain why.
Well, you can be on the set and it's suddenly used too freely, and there's certain things you can't fix in post. There's certain things that would no longer look organic if you did it in post, really. You know, it's one thing removing a mountain in the background of a shot. It's another thing adding 15,000 people and, you know, changing somebody's face. And, you know, that kind of manipulation, I think, gives itself away eventually.
When you watch a movie? Can you pick it out?
Mostly, yes. But then it's interesting because sometimes, you know, on the film Oh Brother, We're Out There, again with the Coen brothers, there's a scene where they hit this cow, right? And they run over this cow. And we had the Society of Protection for Animals, right, ring us up and said, you killed a cow. And they had to go down to the effects house, and the effects guys had to go show them through the stages of how they'd animated this cow to look like it had been run over by the car.
So no car was, cow was hurt in the making of this movie.
Well, they said that at the end, I think, didn't they? No cow was hurt in the making of this movie. So sometimes it, you know, for most people, I look at it, if I really studied it, I thought, well, I'd see an edge there. The shadow's not quite the same on the cow as it is to the tree over there or whatever. You know, it doesn't seem in quite the same space. But, you know, you really have to look at it hard.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia and watch a video and listen as Deakins narrates how he shot a scene from No Country for Old Men.
And we stay in the movie house. If you're a big Michael Jackson fan, chances are you've already seen or you plan to see the concert film This Is It. It opened in theaters last week. Thousands of showings in the U.S. and around the world had already sold out before anyone but studio execs had seen the film, which might make reviews irrelevant, but Bob Mondello had one anyway.
Would have been quite a concert from the looks of the rehearsal footage.
I gotta cue that. That shouldn't trigger on its own.
That should be a special.
That can't trigger on its own.
Our girl.
The This Is It concerts were to blend live performance with film sequences, a 3D thriller graveyard bit so elaborate it turns into a sort of Phantom of the Sports Arena, dancers leaping from spring-loaded trapdoors, Rita Hayworth tossing the former gloved one her glove, and the point of it all, Michael Jackson, front and center. Cobbled together by director Kenny Ortega from more than 100 hours of high-definition rehearsal footage, This Is It has music from the concert that wasn't to be, interrupted by unrevealing but welcome backstage glimpses of a hard-driving king of pop in the last 4 months of his life. Ortega was the director of what was to have been London's live comeback concerts. After Jackson's death in June, he became keeper of the star's cinematic flame. He's made it seem as if, in rehearsal, a perfectionist Jackson is calling most of the shots and creating all of the magic.
Michael, do you like this, first of all?
Yeah, that's a cool move.
Okay.
Cool move, but it spreads out too much at the end.
To answer the vaguely necrophilic question many viewers will have going in, Jackson looks healthy. Thin, but not painfully so. No obvious signs of sleep deprivation. He keeps up with or outdoes a company of pole dancing aerialists and muscular backup dancers who look to be half his age. Because the footage was shot for Jackson's private library rather than for exhibition, Ortega doesn't have the extra camera angles and cover shots that would allow him to cut away every few seconds, which is a good thing. For once, you can actually see the dance moves, Jackson punctuating every lyric with hip thrusts, crotch grabs, twirls, and skittering ankle twists that propel him across the stage as if solid floorboards were a conveyor belt. When the director is playing with technical aspects of the stage show, you get a feel for what might have been in concert. I could have done without a Heal the Planet bit involving a little girl and digitized butterflies, but Ortega's on firm ground whenever he's showing Jackson simply working, tentative at times, performing at a level that might not cut it in front of an audience, but is clearly getting there.
Get me out, bam! Some right there. Mm-hmm. Into the nighttime. Walls won't hold me tonight.
There's nothing in This Is It that will diminish Jackson in the eyes of fans, and plenty that will impress folks who know his work only from music videos and recordings. If you're looking for some insight into the star, or even a full-screen close-up of his surgically sculpted face, This Is It won't be it. But if you're looking for showmanship, it's everywhere. I'm Bob Mondello.
They say,
And now we're going to talk about another concert that actually happened here at the headquarters of NPR. It was a mini concert, what we call here a performance chat. And this was the artist Michelle Ndege Ocello. She's one of the most unique recording artists around. She's made a career challenging the conventions around her about what a pop star or a music star should be. When most women musicians were being promoted as sex symbols, she shaved her head and played the bass. And Ndege Ocello joined Michelle Martin to talk about her music and play a song.
I've often been intrigued by the sort of transcendent quality of your voice, the lucid. And I think to myself, well, what does an angel sound like? If I could imagine, what does an angel sound like? I can easily imagine that an angel could sound like you.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
But then
you don't live with me on a day-to-day basis.
True that. But then I think about songs like Blood on the Curb, yeah. Die Young, this album called Devil's Halo. And I'm wondering, are you intentionally playing with the angelic quality of your voice and these heavy themes?
Oh, you make me sound much deeper than I really am.
is NPR.
I love NPR. Okay. You know, the myth of the devil was once an angel, and there's humanity and imperfection, and imperfection and humanity. I think in us all exists that you're just trying to balance those things. I just try to tell a story with a song and somehow be able to transmit the emotion to you. That's all I'm really trying to do.
Where do you get the inspiration from? You noticed you were mentioning a couple of things happening in the news.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a big source of your
inspiration? Yeah, I used to be
an
infotainment junkie. Then I realized that, you know, even that is wrought with entertainment and to keep you in one sort of, you know, mindset and in fear. And when I grew up, I didn't know a lot about government. I'm hoping we start to educate people more about how the government works and how you can better have an effect on it. I mean, I just got to keep hoping and meditating on change instead of complaining, which I think the society could kind of, you know, hopefully get hip to.
Two squares, they're my best friends, alive with pleasure.
Yes, and Justine, I was there for that performance chat. It was really, some people, they don't bring themselves to a performance or just kind of blank canvases, and the music comes out of them, and you're like, what's the connection between this beautiful music and this person who's just, you know, kind of standing here? But with Michelle Ndege Ocello, I mean, you really got a sense that, you know, the stuff that she's talking about in relationships, she's actually, you know, not just been through them, but sort of she's been the villain. She's not just been the angel or the victim. She's certainly not the one, you know, crying into her pillow at night that somebody's done her wrong. She's sings very beautifully about being on the other side of that.
That's cool. It's got to also be a credit to Michelle. I've sat in, I've come up to 4A during my work day and set it on some of her perf chats, and they're always good. It's always worth the time. So
oh, yeah.
You guys should put together a CD of just her perf chats.
Oh,
how
yes,
about that for
up,
stocking
best
stuffers?
Up. Yeah.
I think that'll solve our economic crisis, I'm sure.
The one here at NPR
exactly.
Certainly will.
All right, well, that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we've talked about and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Alicia Montgomery.
And I'm Justine Kennan. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.